Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now, in terms of how history judges the horror being unleashed against the Palestinian people in Gaza, when we look back at previous horrors, an excuse many in power have fallen back on was they did not know. There isn't that excuse in this particular horror, not that there was in many of those horrors either. And one of the reasons is that there have been so many who have spoken out. Institutions, we have, of course, the ongoing South African case alleging genocide at the International Court of Justice. In Britain, we have had hundreds of lawyers who signed a letter demanding Britain takes urgent action, whether it be arms embargo and the rest, because of the prospect of complicity in genocide. And we also have very courageous individuals, not least Anel Shaleen, who is a former foreign affairs officer at the US State Department, who has resigned over the question of Gaza. And I think history will record what Anel has done as someone who very courageously blew the whistle and took a sacrifice for doing so. Anel, it's such an honor to speak to you. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Do you just want to talk through the moments leading up to this very brave decision of yours? What was going on? What was happening? What made you, you know, what was the process, I suppose?
Yeah. So, you know, I initially, in the aftermath of October 7th, as it became clear what US policy was going to be and what is the Israeli reaction was going to be, I initially thought it would be useful to stay inside the State Department to try to do what I could. I co-authored a dissent cable. I signed two other dissent cables. The State Department held internal discussions about this. Many, many people were extremely concerned. But I think over time, it just became clear that these decisions were being made at the very top. And until President Biden was ready to take a different approach, it didn't really matter all of the work that people were doing. And I want to be clear. I mean, I was within the office that focuses on human rights in the Middle East. Israel-Palestine was not one of the countries I was covering. My work was mostly focused on countries in North Africa. But it did, you know, really undermine our office's ability to just advocate for human rights across the Middle East, not only because members of civil society in these countries didn't want to have anything to do with the US government, understandably, but also what credibility did the US have to advocate for human rights, given what our government was enabling Gaza or inside Gaza?
On that, I mean, I wrote a column for The Guardian on the 24th of October entitled "Israel is clear about its intentions in Gaza. World leaders cannot plead ignorance of what is coming." I wrote that as a marker because I feared after the Iraq war, there was a formulation which was almost identically used by British and American leaders and others, which was, if I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't have. So Hillary Clinton said, if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have voted that way. Deputy leader of the Labour Party, if I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't have voted for it. Almost exactly the same. Michael Howard, a Conservative, if I knew then what I knew now, you know, I couldn't have voted for that resolution. The point I made there is that Israeli leaders just came out and said what they were going to do. It wasn't leaked documents. It wasn't reading, you know, was just they said things like, we're fighting human animals, so we're going to cut off all the essentials of life. You know, all the officials talking about raising Gaza to the ground, creating a city of tents. We're going for, not for accuracy, but for destruction. I mean, it was just so much. Is that part of it? Did you just listen to the intent? Was that, you know, intent is rarely spoken in these ways, I would say.
Exactly. You know, like I said, it was clear quite early on what was going to happen. I mean, I think even, you know, I do commend President Biden for early on telling Israel, you know, don't react the way the U.S. did in the aftermath of 9/11. with just vengeance and pursuing policies that in many ways were counterproductive in the effort to try to contain anger at often justifiable anger at the United States. I think subsequently we've seen, that's really the only thing I can commend President Biden for in the aftermath of October 7th, given his unwillingness to impose any sort of consequences on Israel for the ways that they have continued to violate international law, as well as American laws. I think eventually it did get to the point for me where it was just so clear that U.S. laws were not being followed and the State Department and White House officials were denying reality, claiming that they were not aware of what was happening, what everybody could see with their own eyes, live streaming out of Gaza. And so that, to your first question about kind of the process of deciding, I had made clear to my supervisors that I was going to resign over Gaza, but I was initially just going to do it quietly. And there have been other people who've done that, just didn't want to work for the US government anymore and left quietly. But then it was conversations with colleagues who said, please speak out, and I eventually, only about a week or so before going public, I decided that I would do this publicly, because I agree that it seems to only be public pressure that is having any effect on this administration, even though thus far the effect has been woefully inadequate and quite minimal. But my hope is that it's building and that we will see a change.
I was going to come on to that, because that question of leverage. John Kirby is the White House National Security Communications Advisor. He does some of the press conferences people often see on social media or television. I mean, he said a few days ago that they had had no evidence that Israel was breaking international humanitarian law. And given there is the biggest collapse in the nutritional status of a population in recorded history and famine in Gaza, given 70% of civilian infrastructure so has been severely damaged or destroyed, and Gaza looks like a different color and texture from space, given 40,000 people have been, perhaps including those under the rubble, have been killed. I mean, I could go on. What, you just listen to that, you think, kind of listening to a, they don't, I mean, they can't possibly, but do they believe, I mean, they can't possibly believe that. So they're just lying through their teeth when they say things like that, and they know what's actually happening. They're aware of what's happening.
Yes. Until the president wants the policy to change, we're going to continue to hear this, sort of Orwellian wars, peace, pieces, like the complete convolution of the facts, which I would argue in many ways is contributing to why we're seeing Biden's poll numbers continue to plummet, which is something I'm quite concerned about. I think that the Trump administration would not be better on these issues, and we'd be worse on many issues if we were to get Trump back. But Biden's really, the administration is undermining their case that they have tried to put forward that their administration cares about the rule of law, cares about America's role in the world, cares about supporting allies. Well, I guess they're continuing to support Israel to the exclusion of all of these other considerations, whether it's, the war in Ukraine, the concerns about Russia or China, concerns about climate change, saying they were going to advocate for human rights. This is one of the questions that I still has not been answered for me, which is, why is it that this unconditional U.S. support for Israel seems to outweigh all of these other considerations that I do think increasingly for many Americans, it just doesn't really make sense. Like, why continue to pursue this policy given that they're violating U.S. law to do so?
What do you think is driving it? I mean, it's not, there's Saudi Arabia is another example of a U.S. ally which perpetrates terrible human rights abuses. It's not exclusive, but you can see the impacts that this, the scale of this crime is just so dramatic, it's so obscene. What do you think is driving it? What's your kind of impression of why there was this total unwavering commitment?
I mean, Joe Biden is a self-described Zionist. He's been this way throughout his career. And I do think that much of this does come back to him, which again, remains just so puzzling because, you know, this is part of his whole persona. He is a compassionate person. You know, he's someone that America could trust, over someone like Trump, who just, you know, is so blatantly self-interested. So again, in so many ways, I'm just confused as to why the administration, I mean, again, if it were just this cold political calculus of thinking about their reelection chances, I think he's undermining himself in so many ways, again, beyond just this basic human question of how could you allow this to happen to a group of other people, and to then criticize those who come out and say, I don't want to support what is being done to this group of people. You know, we're all watching it in real time, and it's been 6 months almost.
I mean, on that. Oh yeah, carry on. Sorry, did carry on.
No, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, he was asked about, there was an interview in the New Yorker by Isaac Chotiner. Hold on. This wasn't an interview with you. I'll just double check now. This was, I think, a colleague of yours. Am I wrong here? Was this an interview with you?
I don't think.
No. Yeah, Biden's increasingly contradictory Israel policy. I beg your pardon. It was, I just saw from it, it says a former US State Department official. I was like, oh, wow. No, but in that, what the point that was made was he was asked, you know, talking about, I do wonder if the people who make policy in America don't have the same emotion when it comes to Palestinian lives. Do you think that's fair? And that they responded, this other State Department official, I think it's fair to say yes, that America and Americans have a pro-Israel sensibility. But he was talking there, you know, when he was asked, I do wonder if people make policy in America don't have the same emotion when it comes to Palestinian lives. I mean, it seems so flagrant that Palestinian life is not taken as seriously. Obviously, it has no worth or value, really, when in these discussions. I mean, is that just brutally hardwired into a lot of the decisions made by the US administration?
Yes. I mean, I think we've seen that clearly in, you know, also just the way the mainstream media covers this, the way the use of language in the way, this administration has talked about it. We've maybe seen a little bit on the margins starting to get better because it was so blatant, but I would absolutely agree that Israeli lives are seen as more valuable and sort of similar to the World Central Kitchen workers who were killed. I mean, while it was absolutely horrifying what happened, you know, the outrage over the death of those people, you know, people of European descent and or Canadian or American backgrounds, that generated so much more of an outcry, at least in the US, than in the death of tens of thousands of Palestinians. I do think that sort of the US-Israel affinity does have a basis in racism and sort of counting white lives more than the lives of people who are not viewed as white. But I do think we are seeing a shift here. And one parallel I've made is to the Black Lives Matter movement and the ways that while initially that movement was not really seen as mainstream or people, you know, many Americans wouldn't have necessarily seen themselves as aligned with that. I think, you know, over the course of 2020, it became self-evident, obviously Black Lives Matter. And so I do think we're starting to see a shift also towards the mainstream of we just need a ceasefire, you know, that people who don't necessarily identify with, you know, wouldn't see themselves as like an advocate of Palestinian liberation, they just want a ceasefire. It's not controversial to say we don't want to see any more babies being ripped to pieces or people starving. Sorry.
It's more than understandable. This is a hideous episode in human history, and I share your grief.
Thanks.
In terms of that point you just made about Palestinian life,
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Joe Biden early on sowed doubt in the number of Palestinians who have been killed back in October. And we've seen quite a big, extensive general campaign to sow doubt in those figures. The health ministry in Gaza released at the time a list of names, including the ID, Israel-approved ID numbers, because the civil registry in Gaza is still controlled by Israel, in order to disprove that. And, you know, the UN, you know, in previous conflicts, the figures have been proven to be completely correct. And I'm just wondering about, you know, the administration must know that these figures are an understatement. They don't include those buried under rubble who haven't been identified, for a start. Do you think that's true? I mean, Biden misled people there.
I mean, I was not inside the White House. I don't know what mm-hmm. exactly his staff prepares for him or what he reads, which is not always the same thing. But I do know inside state, those numbers, the widely reported numbers from the Ministry of Health inside Gaza are widely disseminated, come through in emails every day that just sort of come into everyone's inboxes. I myself ran into this when I was working on getting the op-ed I published with CNN, you know, working with the editors there, who, you know, admirably wanted to go through and fact check and, you know, make sure that they were, you know, publishing something accurate, which I, you know, deeply appreciate. But they wanted to use the words Hamas run health ministry or, you know, something along those lines, Hamas controlled. And, you know, to your point, this was something Biden had said initially. And even that isn't really accurate, because the PA pays, or you, at, when there was money getting in, would pay the salaries of many of the employees working in the health ministry inside Gaza. And, you know, and the PA and Hamas are enemies, or, you know, they're not on the same side, if people are not aware. That's the Palestinian Authority, which governs parts of the West Bank, although, again, Israel is in fact in control of the entire territory. So in general, I do just find that whenever it's a question of Palestinians being the victims, it is always interrogated, or there's always this, you know, well, we have to look into that. We have to investigate. We can't call it a genocide. You know, we can't determine what exactly happened. Whereas if it's an accusation again, you know, where Israelis are the victims, there's no need for investigation. It's just assumed, like, oh, well, of course. You know, in looking at for example, the allegations that Hamas committed mass rape on October 7th, and the ways in which, you know, that was used strategically, because when people were polled, that was the issue that really got a huge reaction that people were horrified about. And that, you know, there's subsequently been so much effort to actually try and find, like, well, where are the victims then? And not to say that there were not victims, but just the ways in which some of these claims are, you know, if Palestinians are seen as the aggressor, there's no questioning of, well, let's look into the evidence here. There's perceived to be no need for evidence. Whereas if the Israelis are the aggressors, you know, no, we need to look into that. We can't ascertain that. And to the, you know, getting back to the point about the ways in which the State Department refuses to acknowledge the reality of what Israel is doing, you know, even when there have been investigations and we do have abundant evidence, they're still unwilling to acknowledge it.
I mean, on that, you know, I mean, obviously we're talking there quite rightly, very emotionally about the impact, human impact, and we're talking, you know, 14,000 children is an underestimate because it doesn't include those buried under the rubble. And I mean, it's an unprecedented, in for a very long time, slaughter of children in a very crowded part of the world in which nearly half are of the population are kids. I mean, it just kind of thing, how, you know, because obviously in my head, I say, you know, it must be a soulless bureaucracy making crude strategic, well, all these, we'll talk, I'll ask you about that, you know, about US power and, you know, seeing Israel as a strategic ally. And, you know, the 1980s, Joe Biden, as you mentioned, calling himself a lifelong Zionist. He said in the mid 80s, the Congress, if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to create it. And but made at the point in terms of to serve US interests, that it serves US interests in the region. So he wasn't even making the argument there about a Jewish homeland. He was talking about Israel in the sense that this is a strategically important thing for the US power. I mean, just that impact of just, they must, you know, it's such an obvious obscene crime. Is it just, do you think, how much is that just hitting them?
I don't know. You know, like I said, in terms of, like, you know, I read recently that Dr. Jill Biden has apparently made very clear to her husband that this, she is horrified by this and she wants it to stop. So I assume, you know, she's able to speak with her husband. You know, there has been a little bit of a question of, is this still his advisors? Is this people like Jake Sullivan or Brett McGurk or other people around him? Or is it really just him? And, you know, I don't know, you know, from my window inside the State Department, like I said, I wasn't on the White House staff. But it does, I would just go back to the ways in which, you know, many, many people inside state are devastated by what's happening. And they see it, again, not only in terms of the impact on Palestinians inside Gaza, but on the U.S. standing in the world. And like I mentioned, you know, these other priorities that this administration had identified as existential, whether it's climate change or competition with China, just, you know, the need for countries to work together and the U.S. seeing itself as a leader in those ways. And yet when we come to this question of unconditional support for Israel, the U.S. appears willing to sacrifice all moral leadership, all global credibility, and to essentially behave in ways that do not differentiate it at all from China or Russia or, you know, these other global superpowers that you know, make no claims to care for human rights or to,
yep,
you know, follow the so-called, you know, rules-based liberal international order, which I do think is important to contrast with just international law. The administration likes to talk about the, you know, the liberal international order, but not necessarily just let's adhere to international law and let's adhere to the UN, or let's, when we abstain on a Security Council resolution, we don't get to turn around and say it was non-binding, because Security Council resolutions are in fact binding.
And this was obviously that motion which they abstained on the US and then caused a kind of diplomatic rupture, and then they rode back on it by saying it wasn't binding. Just a few final things, really. I mean, you know, in terms of that point about, well, just about leverage, actually. I mean, I was reading about in the early 80s during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and terrible horrors were then committed, clearly not on the scale that we're seeing currently in Gaza. But an advisor, one of Ronald Reagan, a right-wing Republican, of course, his advisors sort of stormed into the Oval Office, just like, these kids are being slaughtered, this is too much, this has to end. And Reagan ringing an Israeli general and basically ordering them to make it stop. And then the Israeli general saying, you know, they're suddenly committing to all these sweeping changes. And I think what we saw, as you mentioned, horrible, horrible for the families of those Western aid workers, and no one can take that away. But 200 aid workers, mostly Palestinians, have been killed. The biggest killing of aid workers in recorded history, as well as the mass slaughter of Palestinians in general. And then all of a sudden, he did use some leverage, didn't he? Two routes letting food in, aid in, which Israel could have opened all along during a famine. It just shows they did. I mean, they had that leverage, didn't they? He's always had that leverage. All that hand-wringing of Israel. He kept doing all this Israel, you know, private briefings to outlets. He could have used this leverage all along, couldn't he?
Exactly. And there's so much more leverage there to use, which goes back to my point about U.S. law. So under the Leahy laws, for example, if units of a foreign military have been credibly shown to have committed gross violations of human rights, which we have abundant evidence of, you know, prior to October 7th of Israel, you know, units of the Israeli military engaging in these, they are no longer eligible to receive U.S. military assistance. And yet we have not seen the State Department coming out and acknowledging that. Likewise, 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, which says that a foreign government that blocks U.S. humanitarian aid renders itself ineligible to receive U.S. military assistance. Again, Israel in general is no longer eligible. And yet instead we're seeing billions and billions of dollars on top of the already billions of dollars that the U.S. sends to Israel every year. But, you know, so much more in order to enable this. One additional point I think that maybe Americans are not quite aware of is in all so much of this, you know, this money that gets sent to Israel is used in the settlement enterprise to sort of perpetuate this violence and to further entrench the problem. I think, you know, many Americans have just been told for so long, we're moving towards a two-state solution. You know, this is stated U.S. policy. We just have to keep working towards it. But then it is being actively undermined with U.S. tax dollars. And in many ways, I do think sort of the zombie two-state solution is similar to this notion of the ceasefire that the U.S. keeps talking about. We just have to get to a ceasefire. We just have to go back to the negotiating table. But they're not using any leverage to actually make sure that happens. And so instead, why would Netanyahu, whose political future depends on this violence continuing in order to keep himself out of jail, he has no interest in a ceasefire or even getting the hostages back, which, again, you know, the families of the Israeli hostages are protesting because that's not being the priority.
And we know how to get the hostages out in a significant number, ceasefire and prisoner exchanges, because by military means, more have been killed than rescued. Before I ask my final question, I mean, just in terms of international obligations, there was the 1948 Genocide Convention, which lists five crimes. One of them is clearly genocide. The other is complicity in genocide. Now, the US actually dragged its heels for a very long time in ratifying the Genocide Convention until a little known senator from Delaware called Joe Biden ensured its ratification in 1988, four decades on. So then it was ratified in law, its provisions, because of Senator Joe Biden.
Know that.
Yeah, there we go, eh? History, eh? It's a funny thing. But I mean, there is that point that is now, its provisions are in US law, thanks to Joe Biden. And yet there we are potentially with the US complicit in what is being tried as an alleged genocide. I mean, that is the issue there, that alleged that this is about potential complicity in genocide and that the US administration could be complicit in genocide.
Exactly. And we know, I mean, Israeli military officials have said this, that they could not do this without U.S. weapons. And if the U.S. were to cut it off, just as Reagan did in the 80s, they would be forced to radically alter their behavior, which is what Biden needs to do, which, again, is not only in you know, the law that he helped ratify in 1988, but you know, these laws that are actively being discussed inside the State Department, and just they're not being allowed to be upheld, or, you know, the evidence is not being presented publicly.
Just final point. And this is just kind of US power, I suppose. You know, it's interesting. I was in Greece recently. Maybe I'll just look at the Colossus on the hill, just thinking about the rise and fall of civilizations and empires throughout history. And it's interesting because empires, when they're in a bit of a tailspin, they don't realize they're in terminal decline. Because how would you know? How do you don't know your living state? You know something's amiss, and in many previous cases, there was an obvious something is not going right here. Things were, you know, but they think maybe we will recoup it. Maybe things will turn around. If you look at the 21st century, it actually looks like quite steep US decline for lots of reasons. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya all went very badly wrong. Humiliations for military power. I mean, there was Vietnam in the 70s, of course, but you basically had three disasters. In terms of economic, you know, the economic crash, in terms of the rise of Trumpism, just having a right-wing authoritarian movement, which threatens democracy itself. And then you look at this and it's you know, the moral claims of US and Western power in general, a lot of the world were a bit like, don't really believe in that. But it does, it's part of US power, isn't it? And you just kind of look at this and think, how would anyone take what the US says seriously on human rights ever again in any part of the world? They'll just refer to the killing fields of Gaza when little babies were buried under rubble and suffocated and burned to death. I don't know how, you know, what happens to US power after this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think my only glimmer of hope would be that the administration, you know, due to public pressure, shifts and forces this to stop, forces Israel to the negotiating table, allows in the aid, and then, you know, pushes for a Palestinian state. I mean, that would not bring back the thousands and the thousands before who've died. But it would be something to come out of this. And would also, I would argue, lead to greater security for Israel. I mean, the US just always talks about, you know, Israeli security, we have to prioritize Israeli security. Well, clearly the approach of oppression and violence and occupation has not worked for 75 years. So let's try a new approach. And while I don't know if that would be enough to regain any sort of moral leadership, I do think that may be irrevocably lost. I personally would feel that it would at least be a start.
And it's been such an honor speaking to you. And, you know, your humanity and your, I use this term a lot, I think my listeners are probably sick of it, but moral clarity, which for me has been the most important two words since this horror began. It really shines through. And you know, what you've done is courageous. You know, it's not easy to come out, resign from your job and publicly take a stand. But as I keep saying, history is a savage judge. And I think it will look back at this period and it will, as I keep saying in these videos, it will look at who spoke out and who didn't. And I, you know, I've got to the point now where people who still support this, I'm kind of like, well, you're so beyond, like, you're so beyond any kind of moral understanding of the world I have. I can't even negotiate with that anymore. But it's people who stay silent. That's I'm struggling with that a lot, actually. People who know this is wrong, but they won't speak out. They're scared. I get it. They're worried about the backlash. They're worried about the consequences. But it's not good enough. And that's why it's so important people like you have spoken out. You've shown leadership, moral clarity, and you encourage other people to speak out. And also you lay a marker. There was no excuse. People knew. They chose to either listen and act, or they didn't. So thank you so much. Do, for those watching or listening, do share this video. Press like, subscribe. Do leave your comments. We'd love to hear them. But Anal, thank you so, so much. It's such an honor.
Thank you. Thanks for having me and for drawing attention to this.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.